Hey everyone, and welcome back to Mom Notes. This week we have a really awesome guest. Her name is Shelby, and she is the head of choral activities and choir director at a local women's college here in our area. And she had a lot to say about being a mom and also being a mom who also teaches higher ed. And I'm kind of like fangirling over her a little bit during our talk. She's inspiring without meaning to be inspiring, if you know what I mean. Do you agree with that, Nicole? Like, she was talking with her son, and I was like, you're rocking this. Like, don't ever doubt yourself. She made me feel bad I don't play with my kids enough. I was like, you're so awesome singing and playing games all the time. I'm like, entertain yourself.
Yeah, no, she has done so much, but she says it so like, this is just my life and this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And this is how it's going. She's so even keeled and calm. She's worked with my students before. They all really like her. She's really on top of it and organized, but also has this like really down to earth presence and bringing you into it. And we just really enjoyed speaking with her. And something I wanted to plug of hers before we get into her interview, she is very modest about this, but she has an awesome blog with the American Choral Directors Association, ACDA, on choralnet.org. And she posts down there every so often. I just read her most recent post. It was at the end of April, which is recent, is when we're recording this. And it was so helpful. It was about how to teach choir coming out of this year. So she's very wise and a good friend, and we think everybody will really enjoy hearing from her. Our first professor of choral music.
Yeah, a first higher ed mom.
Yes.
And I loved her. Well, y'all see in the interview, she has awesome things to say about treble choir too, which
yeah.
I love a good treble choir. So without further ado, here comes Shelby.
Ooh, is this your office at home?
No, well, this is actually my husband's office. So there's his computer set up over there and all of his stuff in the curio and the bookshelf. And then like dad's stuff here and my computer that I'm at over here.
No, I'm in my husband's office too. He's got all the stuff.
Yeah.
I don't get an office.
So, home. I mean, my office at school, you know, I can mostly go into whenever I want. So I don't need one here, but this year I sort of regret that.
Yeah. Is he working from home?
Yes. He's the stay-at-home dad.
He always or just this year?
Always.
Okay.
So he does things from home, but his job is the stay at home dad. So,
awesome. I can't wait to get into that. That's gonna be fun to talk about.
Yeah. Does he like it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, until my grandfather passed away in 2009-ish, I never really saw myself having kids. Like that wasn't part of my plan. And it was earlier than 2009, but that wasn't really part of my plan. I was going to get my doctorate, I was going to go teach college and all of that. And then, you know, that changed things. And I wanted to continue being part of the kind of family tradition. I'm an only, you know, so there was, if I was going to continue, whether it was the family name or the family lineage or, you know, whatever, it had to be me. And so I was like, okay, and I, to their credit, I never really got any pressure from my parents about that. But you know, when he passed away, I was like, you know, maybe I'll rethink things. And by that point I was seeing somebody who was in a totally different stage of their life. They already had kids and were not interested in having more. And I was like, okay, well, I guess this is a deal breaker now, though it wasn't before. So sorry, bye.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I met Donovan, and it has worked out wonderfully. You know, he, came from a bigger family, and he had much more experience with children than me. I had changed maybe 2 diapers in my entire life before I had my only child. Maybe 2, that's generous. so I had 0 experience. So it was, I don't know. It wasn't something like, oh, I always wanted to be a mom. That just was never my thing. Uh-huh. And even now, sometimes I'm like, I'm not very mom, you know, even though I don't really know what that means, but you know, mm-hmm. I'm not very quote unquote mom in some respects. And so that's, I don't know, that I got my newborn. I was like, what do I do with it now? like, they cannot let me go home with this. I'm going to break it. You know, I don't know what to do. First night in the hospital was bliss. Second night in the hospital, they didn't tell me that the second night was terrible and they don't sleep. And it was madness. And I was like, no, I can't do this. But, you know, he's almost 3, so it's fine.
He's alive.
Yeah, he was always going to be the stay-at-home parent, but I think we had planned to have more, I don't know, childcare, daycare.
Right.
You know, not daycare necessarily, but preschool, or, you know, take them to the library and take them to gymnastics and swimming and stuff. And we were doing some of that right when the pandemic hit, you know, when he was like 18 months or whatever. You know, he had started a little toddler's gymnastics class, and he'd started, and he was just running over all the other children.
I actually just was looking at toddler gymnastics for this summer, and Alex was like, I don't know. And I was like, I think she'll love it.
Yeah. I was looking at doing dance for Jones.
Yeah.
It was kind of lukewarm.
I mean, it depends. Like there were girls in tutus and stuff who were very like, I will stand in line, I will follow directions. And then there was my child who was like,
that will be my kid.
Yeah. But it was great because he got to bounce on the trampoline and run around and like climb stuff, and mm-hmm. they learned how to climb ladders and with, you know, ample safety things underneath them, and he got to jump off things that he wouldn't break himself when he jumped off. So I really miss those things.
Yeah.
You know, we used to go to the playground all the time. We don't do that. I think we were planning on putting him in a preschool class this fall, but now we're still like, I don't know. So who knows?
How did you meet your husband?
We were doing musical theater in Indianapolis. While I was doing after my undergrad, I took a year off to get married. That didn't work, but we did get married. I took a year off to get married, and then I went back for my master's degree, and that was at Butler in Indianapolis. And in that time, there was a theater in Indianapolis, a professionally managed community theater that needed an accompanist. And so I joined in as an accompanist for one show. And then for the next show, I was the assistant musical director. And then for the spring show that year, they said, hey, can you conduct? And I was like, sure. I mean, I was barely 20. I don't think I was even 21 at the time. And it was anything goes. I loved it. It was great. You know, I've been doing musical theater all my life, from the directing side, from my, you know, my family grew up doing it, all of that. So that's in the blood. But that was the beginning of 9 seasons at that theater for me.
Oh, wow.
So basically I started there. I started on my master's in Indianapolis, finished my master's in Indianapolis, continued working at Civic, got divorced, then went back to Ball State for my doctorate and continued working at Civic while I was doing my doctorate. You know, so it was the biggest constant for 9 years of my life. And in that, I met Donovan. The first show that he was in that I musical directed, I remember him being like a chorus guy, right? I didn't really know him. I was seeing somebody, he was still married to somebody else at the time. And then a year later, we came back to do another holiday show, and I wasn't seeing anybody and he wasn't seeing anybody. And we're like, hey, I think we know each other. Why don't we have coffee? You know, it was just this. And then like 4 months later, I said, oh, by the way, I'm interviewing for a job in Indianapolis, or job in Virginia, right? Which he knew. And I was like, hey, I got the job in Virginia. So do you want to move there? I mean, it was all like, and at that point, you know, the contract was a year. I was like, okay, I'll come out here for a year. We'll do this. It'll be great. You know, we weren't married. We were just like, okay, it'll be fine. 11 years later, we're still here. You know, we have a kid somewhere in there. We got married. And we, you know, we have a giant St. Bernard, two cats, a son. And I'm tenured at Hollins, you know, this is my 11th year. So it was not the journey I expected to take. but if you would have asked 20-year-old me or even 30-year-old me, they would have been like, this is no, not what I expected.
I never knew any of this.
Wow. I didn't know about the Indianapolis and wow.
Are you from there? Are you from Indiana?
I grew up in Illinois and I went to high school at a residential school in the suburbs of Chicago, the Illinois Math and Science Academy, for the nation's only three-year residential high school for students gifted and talented in mathematics and science or something like that. So I was the nerd kid, but the nerd school had an amazing music program. Great band, great orchestra, show choir, all the stuff that my had lost its referendum home school district didn't have anymore. So, you know, it had elective classes that I wouldn't have had access to. It had, you know, math and science classes I wouldn't have access to. And so I moved off to high school at 13. I think my parents lost their minds.
It was like, it was residential.
Yeah.
Oh.
And you were their only child.
Yeah. It was 45 minutes away. So, I mean, they still came for all the concerts and stuff, but I don't think I fully appreciated at the time exactly how, soul crushing that must have been on my parents.
Yeah. For me to
be like, here you go, 13-year-old, go, you know, and now having one of my own, I'm like, I don't want to let him out of the yard. So that program, you know, all of the college counseling stuff at that high school, got me a chance to audition at all these places. And one of them was DePauw, and DePauw with a W, in Greencastle, Indiana. So I ended up there as a music major in trumpet, not voice.
No,
I was an instrumental person. Primary trumpet, piano just for fun. Voice, I mean, I was in choir, but I wasn't a voice person. I tried music ed. I didn't quite gel with it at the time. In hindsight, I wish I would have taken more of the classes. I mean, I eventually took them in my master's and stuff, but then I finished, you know, I did my trumpet recital and all that stuff. I was in band and orchestra, jazz band, all that stuff. But piano was sort of I use this to make money, you know, accompanying kids for solo and ensemble, accompanying choirs in the area, doing all that kind of stuff. And then I started my master's at Butler as an instrumental conducting major. And then there was a shift of faculty. And basically the person who was going to teach me for a semester wasn't available. And they said, well, take your core conducting class, you know, take your core other music classes, but why don't you go study with the choral people for a semester? And I did, and I loved it, and I never went back.
You're with Passover. We got you.
Yeah.
Inside.
But, you know, I've always sung, I've always been in choir, so it wasn't foreign to me. But that was never I got to my master's and hadn't taken diction before. So all these other choral majors had taken undergrad diction, you know, French and German and whatnot. And I was like, okay, hold on here. But to their credit, you know, the people at Butler were amazing and I loved them. And I was like an accompanist / assistant director for one of the choirs there. So that got me podium time as well as practicum kind of stuff. And that really helped. All the while I was still conducting at Civic. So I was doing voice work with the singers and also conducting the orchestra. So it worked. And then I did straight up choral for my doctorate at Ball State. And that's that. Then I ended up at Hollins.
So your doctorate is in choral conducting or just choral ed?
Yeah. Choral conducting. It's a DA, so a doctor of arts. So I had to focus on, you know, different cognates, but my primary cognate was choral conducting. And I did other music education work, right? But That's one thing that I'm an oddity in that I don't have a K-12 licensure. I never did K-12 licensure.
Oh, wow.
Because for a music program that doesn't have music ed, we don't have music ed at Hollins. That wasn't part of the job search.
Okay. Wow. I didn't know. Really, so what courses do you teach at Hollins? Like, you do the choral program.
Mm-hmm. I teach three small choirs that in a normal year meet all together as well as separately. But of course this year,
we'll just leave this year current.
Yeah. We just want to talk about this year. But I teach all those choirs each semester, and then I rotate a different course like every four semesters. So I teach a first year seminar one fall, then the spring I teach a conducting class, so like conducting one. And then the next fall I teach sight singing and ear training one, so aural skills one for the majors and minors. And then the spring semester I teach an elective of my choice, which sort of depends on the semester. Sometimes it's aural skills two. Sometimes it's like choir tour during J term, you know? So sometimes that's my credit, is a January term class. This coming year I'm teaching, like next year I'm teaching race and racial bias in Western traditional music. So wow. Basically all the stuff that got left out of Grout,
right.
You know, the things that they don't learn in the regular classes. I mean, not in our classes necessarily, but just the things we don't talk about, that we need to talk about. And, I had a student ask me, you know, do we have any classes like this? And I was like, well, we don't, but give me some time and I'll think about it. And so that's what's coming up next spring. It's certainly not fully fleshed out, but I have all the topics, you know, and like all the things I want to do. So
like you created the class.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Wow.
That's really cool.
Yeah. It's fun and exciting. But it's also an odd mix in that, you know, each semester I'm teaching choirs and one other thing for the most part. But that one other thing differs.
Sarah, I'm feeling faint. I think
you're feeling faint.
I think I need some food and some recipes.
Some more recipes
from hungry. Tell me something yummy.
Okay, so this is a recipe kind of concept that I kind of keep in my back pocket. And I typically do this once a week. So I call these like burrito bowls. And it's basically, the foundations are kind of the same every time. As always, I do cilantro lime rice, like a Chipotle copycat. I always have some kind of meat. Usually it's chorizo sausage because that's super fast. I always do some kind of like guacamole or like quick homemade ranch dressing, and then some cheese. And then everything else is just kind of things I have in my fridge. So if I have pickled red onions, which I usually do, I throw them on there. If I have veggies just sitting in my fridge, like I'll roast them in the oven real quick and throw those on. If I have, you know, avocados, I'll make guacamole. If I have tortilla chips, boom, those become like the croutons. Usually some kind of lettuce greens that gets thrown on. What did we have today? I had like wonton crisps from a salad left over. I threw that on. So it's kind of a fridge clean out, like any kind of salsa you have or yogurts or cheeses, even hummus. It kind of all gets thrown in and you just make like this yummy, like, Chipotle style burrito bowl. You can do whatever meat you want, any leftover beans you want, any salsas or veggies or lime wedges, cilantro, green onion, just go crazy. So I think what I'll do is write up my like basis for it. So I'll write my homemade ranch and my cilantro lime rice, because I found a recipe and kind of tweaked it and made it my own that it always works. One of my biggest pet peeves is when rice doesn't work. When I mess up the rice, I get really mad. But this,
we have big arguments in my house about rice, because brown rice takes forever, but I like it better. It's better for you. My husband hates brown rice because he can never cook it.
I'm team Alex on this one. I do not like the taste.
I'm not surprised.
And it takes way too long. It takes way too long and it tastes worse. So what's the you just put a few less scoops of it and more lettuce in your bowl.
Okay.
Okay.
All about a good clean up.
Yeah. And this, it really takes like half an hour, not even, because you're cooking the sausage, you're cooking the rice. That does not take that long.
That's what we want after a day of teaching and mommy.
Yeah. And it tastes like $1 million. You feel like a rock star.
All right. Burrito bowls. Do you feel like that's so interesting to me that you don't have K-12 experience. Like, do you feel like you wanted that and just didn't happen? Or are you like, you wanted to go straight to higher ed?
I think it was just the way that worked out. You know, had I done my undergrad with music ed, I think I would have taken a different path, right? Because I was friends with the music ed people. I hung out with the music ed people. I took percussion techniques and I took brass techniques and I took string techniques. I took a lot of those classes as an instrumental music ed major. I just didn't finish that piece of it. I finished just trumpet performance. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that I wasn't in the right mindset at the time to go straight into teaching. I don't think that would have been a good fit for me. But I liked doing shows and I liked the pedagogy aspect of it. And then I started my MM at Butler. In hindsight, maybe I would have done an M-Ed. But I don't know. I mean, I still took music ed courses. I just didn't focus on that as my licensure piece. And then when I was at Ball State, you know, I took all the music ed courses as my secondary cognate, but that wasn't my final project. My final project was a choral, choral recital. It wasn't, and research, you know, dissertation kind of thing. It wasn't music education based, but I still did teaching in various classes at Ball State. I was a TA. I taught intro to conducting, you know, so there was a lot of teaching aspects, but never the licensure bit.
So what was your dissertation focus? Was it just the recital or did you have like a specific?
Choral works for women's voices, actually by women for women, colon.
Okay.
Choral works for women's voices. I had never conducted a women's chorus until I got to Ball State. I conducted SATB choirs and, you know, all sorts of mixed groups and whatnot, but I never had a women's chorus. And at the time it was women's chorus, right? I hadn't gotten on the Ball State, certainly hadn't at that point either, of treble and bass, you know, they weren't there yet. But it was the women's chorus, everybody in their matchy dresses and stuff, which in hindsight, I'm like, oh man.
I think we've all felt that even as a undergrad, it was women's choir, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's still called that because it just is that way in the curriculum.
Yeah. And so I guess when I got to Ball State, there were three other grad students who came in at the same time. And there were two guys and me. And one of them got assigned, the younger guy got assigned the men's choir, and the older guy got assigned to the Y'all Come University Chorale. And I got assigned the women's choir. And I was like, oh, okay, I don't know anything about this repertoire. So I started digging into the archives of the music library, the choral library. Oh, mm-hmm. What can I pick? What can I learn about? Blah, blah, blah. And I hated it. All of the repertoire was so terrible. It was all this, you know, the phrase is butterflies and flowers, you know.
Flowers,
Or all of this schmarmy, smaltzy kind of stuff. And I'm like, I like Brahms as much as the next person. Some of it is beautiful, but, you know, it doesn't all have to be that. We are pining for our life to be fulfilled. I'm like, seriously? Come on, we got to have other stuff to sing about. And then that turned into my dissertation because I got tired of not finding repertoire that I liked for my choirs that maybe was written by a woman or had text by a woman or was originally written for women's voices, not mixed choir and then rearranged sometimes badly.
Mm-hmm. What year was that around?
2006 to 2009. I started at Ball State at 06 and I finished in 09.
I was going to say, because I feel like when I first started teaching, which was 2000, 11, it was the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like only
just recently are there starting to be really fun, good quality. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Women. And I mean, I made some amazing connections, you know, with community women's choirs and the directors of those community women's choirs and all sorts of groups that I never necessarily would have connected with because that wasn't my path at Ball State. But I remember going to the Oklahoma City ACDA conference. Oklahoma City. And, you know, just finding all of these tables of independent composers and, hey, I know you, I'm doing a dissertation on this, can we talk? You know, and walking away with a suitcase full of stuff that then I had to go look at and decide what am I going to program and all of this. And then eventually my dissertation was taking 150 pieces, give or take, and making annotations on them. So like, what's the range and what is this text sacred or secular and what's the topic and what's, you know, what's the length of it and what language is it in? And here's a blurb about the text and here's a blurb about the music and here's the year it was written and here's the composer and here's the publisher or here's how it's self-published, you know, all the data points that you need. What's the accompaniment? Because I thrive on data points and spreadsheets and things.
Math and science.
Yeah,
it's connected.
My students suggest that that's my superpower and they're not wrong. Sadly, I only have enough superpower energy to do it for home or for work. I can't ever figure out how to do them both at the same time.
We shall talk about that.
Yes.
In summer, I'm like, oh, let's organize all the things at home. And my husband's like, no, stop. You know, or I'll go into school like, oh, I'm going to organize all these things and it's great. I'm going to put all this stuff in a database and then I'm going to come home and go, I can't even like make a store list. Like my brain, there's nothing left in my brain to do this. So I have learned that I can do one or the other, but both is, so far not very successful at both. But yeah, so that was my dissertation. I taught the women's chorus for 3 years at Ball State. I focused on work for women's voices, specifically, you know, making sure that these singers in the ensemble had texts which could reflect them and things that they cared about and were interested in. And I look back at my dissertation now and I'm like, there's some stuff I would say differently. Like I talked about feminist and like community lesbian women's choirs, but I didn't say anything about trans students or how they fit into this, you know, because that wasn't even on my radar at the time. And in hindsight, I'm like, how did I miss that? But I don't know. I can't go back and re-edit my dissertation at this point. It's time capsuled as of 2009. You know, I can't change it.
I think that's how the mindset was in 2009.
Yeah.
Like if I'm thinking that, like I wasn't even.
You were ahead probably.
Yeah. Those issues weren't even on my radar. I mean, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so that's how I got to Hollins, because Hollins is a traditionally, historically, women's college, though not all the students identify as women, but historically speaking, it's a women's college. And so all of my ensembles are soprano alto. And so, you know, the job came up on my radar and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna audition for this. I'm gonna submit my application. And I think it just was a really good fit because I already had sort of a mindset towards working with upper voices and repertoire for upper voices. It was a really good fit. In some respects though, it's more, I don't want to say difficult, but it's not like I can take my dissertation and apply it directly to my students at Hollins, because while it's a women's college, they don't all identify as women. And even those that do are certainly on a spectrum of different ways they perceive themselves. So me saying we should all have music that speaks to us, you know, there is no one universal us. It's all individual people, and trying to find that balance of, you know, do I want to do women identified texts that support women's authors and women's history? Well, then is that too much women centric for a group that isn't all women? And finding that balance while not silencing the women's history piece of it as well, because that needs to be heard too. So that's always something that I I try to navigate around, and it changes every year, every semester, you know, depending on the students I have, and depending on, I don't know, the repertoire and what we're trying to do. So
what are some of your favorite by women for women pieces?
Oh,
hold on. I'm getting out my phone. I'm writing. Cause I mean, I love my boys and my tenors and basses and however they identify, you know, they sing tenor and bass.
Right.
I mean, man, I love my treble choirs.
Yeah. They're special.
Well, I'll plug my blog here. I do a blog once a month, give or take, on CoralNet. So ACD is coralnet.org. And it's about repertoire. So like I do a new piece every month.
We'll have to put that in the notes, the show notes.
Yeah, yeah.
But on there, I've got sort of favorite pieces. And then I talk about how to teach those pieces, or at least how I've taught them. So like, hey, if you want a piece that's really good with, or that's got tricky rhythms and you really want to focus on teaching them rhythms, or they're already good at rhythms and you want an easier piece for them, you know, wherever your students fall, this is a great one for this. Or, hey, if you want to try La-based minor solfege, this is a great piece to jump into that, you know. Or I taught this using Takadimi, da-da-da-da-da, and these were the resources I used, you know. So, or things like, hey, most of this is ostinato, so this sounds really complicated, but goes together easier than you think.
The piece that I stole from you, that was Anne Miriam Singh.
Yes.
That song, we were so ready to do that at assessment last year, and then it, you know. But
I'm writing these down.
That was one that Shelby brought her students to perform for my students, and we were like, ooh, and it sounds super complicated. So not.
Like, you look at it, there's like, ooh, the beginning section is, it's called Anne Miriam Sang, and it's in the CME for higher voices thing of the Doreen Rao group. But, you know, that's one of them, that the second sopranos come in with something, and they continue for like ever. And then the altos come in, and then the first sopranos come
in. It's also a good story.
Yeah, repertoire has always been my thing. So I like, this is a random one, but I like Jax Valentine by Libby Larson. It's a hysterical poem. And it's Jack Kerouac-esque kind of poem. And, you know, it's about these random moments and stuff. And then a lot of stuff by Libby Larson, a lot of stuff by Joan Shimkoe, a lot of stuff by, oh no, I'm going to blank. Oh, okay. I can have a list.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll give you a list.
That's what people are looking for. That's what we are looking for. We want the list.
Yeah.
What to order. Yeah. What can our kids sing?
So that's, you know, hey, you want a piece that's heavy on this and light on this, or it's, has to be accompanied because I'm doing it on the same concert as X, or has to be unaccompanied, or hey, right. I already have a violinist for this concert. What else can I do that also uses violin? You know, so that's my thing. Since I've had a kid, I don't do so well with like, tell me a piece off the top of your head. And like,
my head is full.
That's like part of my brain is gone.
Give me 5 minutes to find me my most recent spreadsheet and I will tell you all the things.
Most recent spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Do you make spreadsheets for home for like momming?
Oh yeah. I think that might be the trait that makes my husband nuts. There's one like on the inside of the cabinet that has all the stuff I do in the morning with James, because that's when I spend my most time with James, is in the morning, because as a college professor, I have more flexibility on when I teach my classes to an extent. So at least this semester, I don't teach before 10, but none of my choirs meet until after 4:30. So like my day on a regular day doesn't end at least until 6:15, usually 6:30. So it's still a day, but it's, like, I don't have to be in the office at 8 a.m., but I also don't leave at 4:30 when most of my college colleagues are like, hey, I'm done. I'm like, and I'm starting rehearsal. Bye. Mm-hmm. You know, and my kid's like, I'm ready for dinner in bed. I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm not home yet. But you know, it's 8:20 and I'm in the basement office. I still hear him running around upstairs with my husband because he has a late bedtime, which, you know, like I feel guilty that he's not already in bed at this time, but because I don't get home until 6, we don't do dinner at 5:30 and bed at 7, because otherwise I'd never see him. So I spend a lot of my time in the morning with him, and those are our routines. You know, did we let the dog out? Did we feed the cats? Did we empty the cat litter? Did we take the trash out? Did we go for a run? Did we, you know, and we have little songs, like now that he sings along with me, laundry, litter, workout, laundry, litter, workout, you know, and we'll sing it along, like whatever our next things are. So dishes, breakfast, potty. We're in the middle of potty training.
Sending vibes and prayers.
I don't know. I mean, it's mostly my husband because he's the one who's home during the day, but every once in a while,
it's
I'm like,
boy training a boy, you know, with my boy, I'm going to be like, hubby, this is on you. You know how all that works down there.
I'm like, but I don't know how to do this. You know, that I think that's the hardest thing that I did not anticipate with taking a job halfway across the country and being an only child and not really having cousins who have kids that are my kids' age and not really having, you know, extended family with kids who are my kids' age and joining a department whose people were primarily my parents' age or who have kids that are at a very different stage in life than me. You know, there's no village here, especially not during a pandemic, but even in general, we have no village. So I don't think I anticipated how difficult that would be because I didn't know what I didn't know. Mm. Like, okay, hey, we're thinking about potty training. Where am I supposed to go for ideas? Because I don't have anybody, you know, my friend or my cousin or my sister who did it 6 months before me with their kid. You know, the learn by example piece is abjectly missing. From our lives. So
I'll tell you where you go to the Music Teacher Mommy's Facebook page.
Yes, absolutely. all the things, or you know, and I'm on an academic moms, you know, group, and like collegiate professors kind of stuff. And one post will be about, hey, I'm working on a syllabus, and the next is, okay, I'm potty training my kid. And you know, so it goes all over the place. But that and like a group of a high school Facebook chat with people who were in my class. So they're all about my age who have kids about my age, my kid's age or older. Right. Just sort of watching them go through it. That was kind of the best I could accomplish. I don't think I realized the challenge in taking a job so far away, but even had I stayed in Illinois, or Indianapolis, you know, I don't know. I never really hung out with people who had kids. That wasn't my friend group. And so trying to pick up experiences about, so how do I do this mom thing? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, I don't have any mom friends. I don't know who to, okay.
Well,
I'm going to Google this, you know.
Because how old is he?
He's 3 and we tried some more. It was a long journey to get pregnant with James, filled with lots of extraneous intervention. You know, we ended up doing IVF here in Roanoke once Dr. Evans Hoker came to town and had an IVF practice. Because when we started trying to get pregnant with James, they were like, well, there are a couple infertility doctors, but you know, there aren't a lot of options. Like there was no IVF in town. And so when she came to that practice, we were like, okay, let's try this. And it worked on the first try.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing. It was a long journey. And I think, you know, I'm 40 now, 41, 40, I'm 40. Yes, I'm 40. I was born in 1980, so I'm 40 and I will turn 41 next September. But it will, you know, he's almost 3. He'll be 3 in May. And so the question is, we still have embryos frozen, you know? Is that, are we going to make him a sibling? Is it going to work this time? Are we going to be as lucky this time? Are we, you know, that it works on the first try? You know, it's much cheaper to do a frozen transfer of embryos that are already pre-cooked, you know, pre-combined and, you know, from the first round of drugs and stuff. But yeah, it was a long journey. There was lots of, you know, we'd go home to Illinois for a Christmas or a summer or whatever. And I'm like, I'd start crying when we'd get into town, you know, I don't want to come home again without a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, it was
it's a hard thing.
You know, but then it worked. And the irony is, you know, my husband said this when I told him I was doing this podcast. He's like, you should say something that, how naive were we that we thought we could order a kid like a pizza, you know? Like but I mean, when we first started trying, we're like, okay, well, we'll try this month and this next month, but not the month after that, because we don't want you to end up having the baby in the middle of your holiday concert, you know, because there's right. nobody else. Because it's at a college, you don't like hire a sub. Like I don't have, so I was like, I don't know what to do. If I go on maternity leave, my program just dies. What happens? In the end, I found somebody to cover for me. And in the end, we did order a kid like a pizza, in that we did an August IVF, and he was born in May to line up with the end of the semester. I mean, he was a week and some late, so really he was supposed to be born in April. By the time May came around, I was like, this child better come out now.
Yeah, because the due date month gets in your head.
Oh yeah. Well, I had a sub person all lined up, you know, a person from Roanoke who was able to come in and do my end of the semester pops concert. They normally sing on the quad, all of this. And I was supposed to be out like 2 weeks beforehand and have a baby. And I didn't, and I hadn't. And I finally went into labor like the day before the concert.
Oh no.
And again, totally naive. We went to the hospital. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in labor. They're like, you're 2.5 centimeters. You're just, no, go home. I was like, no, please.
Please take
me. Your so
I came home and I sat on my little ball and I took a shower for like 6 hours and I sat on my ball some more and I walked around the house. And then finally there was a point where I'm like, okay, I'm holding onto the fridge. We're going to the, you know, yeah. By that point I was not making coherent decisions. My mom was like, we're going to the hospital, you know, cause she was here at the time. So they threw me in the car and I went, they're like, oh, you're almost 8. Yay. Congratulations. And then I had
James
and I was done.
How dreadful that ride is.
Oh. Yeah.
Like, I swear to God, if you hit another bump.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like, just get there.
And it was like 9 o'clock at night or something, you know, so it's dark and I'm like, I'm trying to hold on to the seat, but I have to wear my seatbelt. But I'm like, I can't just, no. Oh
yeah.
Just,
it's so terrible. That ride. It's like, oh, I'll just get in the car. And then it happens. You're like, I can't get in the car.
Yeah. There was a moment where I'm like, I mean, I finally gave birth to him on Friday. There was on Wednesday. I was like, ooh, something's, you know, this might be considered a little twinge, a contraction. I don't know, you know, but it wasn't like any certain number of minutes apart. They were all variable. And they were variable to like late night Thursday, you know? So it had this ongoing thing, but then there was a point I'm like, oh yeah, this is real. Okay. I'm done, you know? And you know, I'd wanted to do it without drugs. I'd wanted to do it on my own terms, and I was able to, but it was, yeah.
Dang. Good for you.
He was 10 pounds and I'm not sure that.
Oh.
Sorry. Can you say that one more time? He was how many pounds?
He was 10 pounds, 3 ounces.
And he was overcooked.
Yeah.
That's past, like my baby was overcooked. That's like, well done.
Yeah. He was overcooked. But I remember when we went to the maternity ward, you know, like you go to the next floor after you've had your baby or whatever. And the nurses are like, you're the one that just had the 10-pound baby with no drugs. And I was like, yeah, that's me. Okay, I'm dying. Goodbye. Can I go to bed? Damn. Thanks.
They should have given you a cape.
Yeah, you get a medal. I always say they don't hand you a medal, but you should have gotten a medal.
Then I think I was like, okay, I'm going to nurse. And then I was like, I don't know anything about this. This is not going to work. And it was like day 9 before my milk came in. So I'm like, my baby's going to starve and I'm not going to, you know, he's never going to eat, you know, and it was, but then we nursed for 2.5 years. Yeah, we just quit at Christmas.
Wow.
So it, you know, it was, I was like, I'm going to go 6 months. No, I'm going to go a year. No, I'm going to go a year and a half. No, I'm going to go two. No, I'm going to go 2.5. I'm like, okay, I'm done. Mm. But it was, yeah, the start of that was not what I expected.
Man, good for you. My goal each time was a year and each kid went to 13 months, mm-hmm. like each of them.
Yeah.
And that was always like, all right, we're done. I love you.
Girl, I made it like 2 days.
I remember that. I was like, girl, just don't do it. Like,
I'm done.
And I mean, I had wanted to do it. I thought, okay, this is something I want to try. But at the same time, I was like, if it doesn't work, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
But man, the first time you have to pump in your office, I'm like, this is so, like, I feel like a cow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never enjoyed pumping. I did use it as an excuse to watch Netflix.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, it should be working. I'm going to watch Parks and Rec.
But you know,
I have to go pump.
It's 7 o'clock.
But I tried to make a conscious choice, knowing that I was at a traditional women's college, to, you know, I put a sign on my door that had an emblem of a nursing mother that said, nursing or breastfeeding, come back later. You know, it wasn't like, I'm not here, or
a picture of a cow. Mommy's right.
Office.
Or I'm on break. It was like, I am nursing, come back later.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a fridge in my office and stuff, so I was able to do it, you know, without a whole lot of trouble. But we took James at 7 months, I guess, on choir tour to Ireland. And so I nursed on the bus, I nursed on the plane, I nursed, you know, in front of my students in that respect all the time. And occasionally with a cover, but like, not really usually, you know.
Oh my gosh. The first one I was so into the cover. The second one was like, IDGAF.
I'm like, it is too hot.
It's too much. Yeah. Like, I just did the double shirt method.
Yeah.
It bothers you look aways.
Yeah. I was like, I got a tank top. I got a shirt on top. I'm good.
Yeah.
But it was, I think it was, that was a piece of it that I didn't expect to be sort of, I mean, it wasn't a challenge because my students weren't unsupportive, but I don't think I expected myself to become like, I'm going to go pump now, you know, or I'm sorry, I can't be at that meeting at this time because that's when I need to pump between classes. Like saying that out loud, or, okay, I'm sitting on a bus with my students and I'm here nursing my son. You know, I guess I never expected it to be something I did in front of other people almost purposefully.
Integrating with your,
yeah.
Your life. Well,
yeah.
Right. But it did. And it, I don't know. I don't remember having any faculty in undergrad who had little kids.
Yeah.
And if they did, I certainly don't remember them like momming in public.
Right.
I guess.
And like in front of you.
Yeah. They were Dr. So-and-so. And if they had kids, their kids existed at home somewhere.
Right.
But they weren't like Dr. Mom at the same time.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if it's because I was at a women's college and so it was easier in some respects, or because I don't know, but that was something that surprised me, but I was pleasantly surprised, I guess.
Do you, in beyond breastfeeding, like after you had become a mom, did it change the way you looked at your career at all or the way you approached it?
In some respects, yeah, because, you know, there were things that, okay, I'm going to go to this festival every year, or I'm going to go to this conference every year. And then I went to my first ACDA conference or whatever it was when he was still nursing. And I'm like, okay, so now I'm not there to put him to sleep at night. I'm not there to nurse him. I have to pump and then carry all this on the plane. My husband's at home for 3 days with my son. This is the longest time I've ever been away from him, you know, that kind of stuff. And it made me just a little nuts. I had a hard time with that, but I did see things differently, I think. Like, okay, this usual, we have a 6-hour rehearsal on Saturday before our fall holiday concert or whatever. I'm like, I don't want to take 6 hours out of my Saturday anymore to do this. Or if I do, I need a break in the middle to pump, you know, so my students can go have lunch, which they didn't usually have they would eat, they'd bring stuff with them, but like there wasn't a, we are on lunch break now kind of time. So it did. And I always fall into the trap, of comparing myself to other college conductors. Right. And that happens all the time. I'm like, I wish I could do that, or I would love to have an ensemble like that kind of thing. But then I look at the fact that, okay, some of these conductors are men who may have kids or may not, but I have no idea, because that's not part of their, you know, public life. Or some of these conductors are women who had their kid in grad school. And so this isn't, you know, their kids are grown now. So I can't compare the amount of free time I have to work on my job to the amount of free time they have to work on their job. Or, you know, looking at, okay, they're at a school that has 60 people in the choir and they're all music ed students. You know, that's not the school I'm at, but I like the school I'm at, but that's not the program there just aren't that kind of numbers at Hollins, because we're a really small school. So I think there were some times when I had to kind of go, okay, I can't do all of this and conduct this festival and do this invitation and go do this interest session and also see my kid.
Right.
And then there were times that I'm like, okay, this is my job. I have to. And I'd get home Sunday night and be like, I haven't seen my kid. And I have to go back to work on Monday, and I'd have, you know, I'd cry and all the things. That still happens.
But will you put thought into, like, maybe I need more Saturdays free than I had before? Or will you, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of where I'm at, is the outside of work hours time.
Yeah, probably. I'm not sure how much control I have over that, because a lot of it is, you know, if we have an orchestra concert and a choir concert and a world music ensemble concert and a something else and a senior recital, you know, all these things that aren't necessarily my concert, but they're other concerts of my department. That's part of my responsibility as a, you know, a senior faculty member to be there. But at the same time, I'm like, man, I don't want to go to another concert for like the fifth Sunday in a row at 3 p.m. You know, yeah. It's hard to balance that. Like, how do I be a good colleague and support other people? But also, I want to go home after my church gig's over on Sunday and see my family.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there are things I will rework in the fall semester, or I hope to. But I think my brain has a hard time figuring out how I'm going to maneuver, because I don't know what anything's going to look like yet. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I want to sing. I want to conduct. I want them to sing. But I don't know what it's going to look like yet.
Yeah. That's a great answer. I don't know.
That's a really good answer.
I think the one thing that again, I was talking to Donovan about, you know, what to say on this, you know, and one thing he pointed out, he's like, you know, you don't have long stretches of time with him, but you have very concentrated time. So like, I get up earlier than I normally would like to and make sure he gets up. And then we spend multiple hours together in the mornings. And that's sort of our us time. You know, my workouts now are mostly running, because I can take him in the stroller, though at 40 some pounds, he's getting a little hard to push uphill. I do miss flat Midwest every once in a while.
Yeah.
The hills in Virginia are kicking my butt.
Especially here. Yeah.
Oh yeah. But you know, I got him a set of like neoprene, weights in his Christmas stocking, so that he could do a workout with mommy and we could like lift weights together. Aww. You know?
Oh, that's so precious.
And we try to cook together on the weekends. Cook. I use that term lightly, because I am not a cook. I like Nicole, you said something about, you know, Alex is the executive chef.
Yeah.
My husband cooks, he does most of the dinners and stuff like that. But on Saturdays I try to pull out a toddler cookbook that my parents got us.
Oh, that's so cool.
Or something, and like, okay, let's make this thing here, and I'll show him, you know, three measuring cups and be like, which one is 1/4? And then he'll pick out the right measuring cup.
Aww.
And so we're identifying that, okay, we need the container that starts with an F for flour. And then he'll go over and try to find it.
That's awesome.
Oh my gosh.
I am so strong. This is so heavy. And he'll bring me over the container of flour, Aww. You know, and he's got his little step stool and a little, you know, a little apron and stuff. So I try to make my time count with him because I know he definitely gets more time with his dad in terms of hours because dad's with him the whole day. And I know that I will never match that in terms of hours spent. So I need to match it in terms of quality, you know? So we're always doing something in the mornings.
I have a really good friend. I'm going to shout her out in case she listens to it, named Janice. And she works at a hospital. So she has very similar, like she'll start late in the day and work into the night and a similar schedule. And I talked to her about, you know, the working mom thing where like you love your job and you love what you do, but you also love your kid and you have that tension that we're talking about. And she always says like, but cause I was talking to her about how the person who's with Aubrey during the day knows these things about her that I don't know. And how I'm like, oh, like that kills me. She was like, she always tells me, she's like, you're her mom. Like I have to tell myself all the time. There's nothing that can replace that. You're her mom. So anytime you get with James, like you're his mom, that's who you are to him. And I think the like quality over quantity thing that Sarah was talking about applies here too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was why I was so reluctant to give up nursing because I knew that absolutely no one else could do that.
That was your bond with him.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, by 2.5, it was Christmas and we're like, okay, it's, you know, we're having like conversations here and it's getting awkward. So, you know, like, okay, it's fine. And you know, I wasn't really in the mood to stop, but at the same time we were, you know, thinking about, should we think about another kid? Like we were thinking about, and they're like, okay, we should, you know, and this is my parents will be here for the holidays. It'll be a good time to just distract him with other people. And if I'm a hot mess emotionally, it's the holidays, everybody's a hot mess emotionally, it'll be fine.
So Shelby, what would be like parting like advice to like a person in higher ed, right, who's also a mom of like young kids? What would be like your words across the universe to them?
Oh, or somebody who's thinking about either of those things or both.
Yeah, thinking about going into higher ed and having a young family.
If you're not in higher ed yet and or you have, I mean, yeah, it depends on the situation. But look at the community and the expectations and stuff of where you are, you know, or where you want to be, and see if that lines up with what you want to do. You know, if I was a single mom, or if I had a husband who also worked a 9-to-5 job, or if I was in a situation, you know, where he was in daycare and I had to go pick him up at 4:00, I absolutely couldn't be in my job that I'm in right now because I teach 4:30 to 6 and I can't change that. You know, so there's, or that's our meeting time at Hollins, which every person who has, I don't know how we've been a women's college with faculty that have kids that still come to the 4:30 meetings. Like that's a terrible time. You know, that's like, I'm going to go pick my kid up. We're going to have dinner. We're going to go to bed, you know, but it's just the way it worked. And I think because I'm in the situation I am with a stay-at-home dad, and a partner who's willing to make that sacrifice, it's something that I can manage. But if I was in a different position or with a different partner or a single mom or whatever, I think it would be really hard to do what I'm doing right now in the time frame that I'm in, because I don't have a lot of control over the time frame. And I think the biggest thing I would tell somebody is try to find a village, right? And I'm terrible at that. I don't make friends well. I don't make mom friends well. You know, that was just never my thing. I made colleagues, but not necessarily friends. And that didn't really weigh on me until I had a son and that didn't have anybody to talk to in that respect who had kids my same age. And the other piece of it is, you know, think about when you're going to have the kids and realize that there's a limit to when you can have them. I mean, had I known at 20 something or 30 something that it was going to take us as long as it did and as much effort and money and time and, oh my God, all the drugs to get pregnant, I think we would have started sooner and been more serious about it. But I didn't know that at the time. You know, I was like, okay, we can try next year. Next year will be fine. And then it was like, okay, it's next year. And that's still not happening. In the end, it worked out beautifully. I mean, I wouldn't change anything about James. But it doesn't always work on the first try. It doesn't always work ever, you know? So, I think I tried to let my students know, I mean, I didn't let them in on all the ins and outs, like, oh, we're doing IVF and I have to give myself shots every day. You know, that's not something I would share with my students. But once we did get pregnant, you know, they knew we did IVF. They knew that it was a long time. They knew we'd been trying for 6 years kind of thing. So that when they grew up to try to figure out how to balance career and mom, if they wanted to do that, to know that sometimes there's a shelf life, you know, sometimes there's an expiration date that you don't get to see. And like I said, we were lucky and I wouldn't change anything, but in hindsight, that's something I wish I had known to be more aware of.
That's good. I also think your story will give a lot of people that I can think of off the top of my head, like by name, a lot of people hope who I know who are struggling with infertility and doing IVF treatments, just to hear, I think that it can work. I think I know it doesn't always, but I think, you know, knowing that's possible is gives people hope.
Yeah. And I'd had a family member who had done IVF, but beyond that, I really didn't know anybody who'd done it or who'd experienced it or who'd had that in their lives. And, you know, certainly nobody that said, okay, you're going to have to get jabbed this many times a day and giving blood is going to be terrible after a certain point. And then you got to take all these drugs and, oh, the hormones and the thing, you know,
emotional toll.
Like, oh yeah. You know, all the crying.
I remember I saw someone's like Facebook post about it, 'cause people are being a little more vocal about it, which I love, 'cause it helps other women. 'Cause you know, you know, people that go through IVF that they kind of told you, oh yeah, I was, I'm like, oh, you can, that's okay. That's awesome. But they would like have pictures of all the shots and like in a row. And I was like, I had no idea, because you just hear about it. You're like, oh, okay, you did that. But like, I naively did not know what it entailed.
Yeah. People need to talk about it more, because it is super common.
Yeah. Yeah.
Super common.
And super common to also not be covered by insurance.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah. Super, super common, but also not super common to be covered. So that's
Well, it should be covered if it's as common as it is. It's like 1 in 4 women or something have at least one miscarriage.
Yeah. And that's a piece of our journey that we never, along our journey, there were many, many months of not getting pregnant, but we never got pregnant and then miscarried. Like, we either didn't get pregnant or we did IVF and we got pregnant. There was never any middle ground. And I don't, but I had I had lots of friends that went through that. So that piece of it, I think I had seen to some degree, and seen like people who were my high school age friends, you know, who were having kids at the same time in their life as me, who had done that or had that experience. And I guess I sort of kind of had a, okay, if this happens, I might maybe know what to expect. But even then you never know what to expect unless it happens, you know? So I can't speak to that either, 'cause that wasn't my journey. But yeah, the shots and the bravery of my husband being willing to give me the shots, knowing that, you know, I might turn around and punch him.
that's a toll on them too, 'cause it's totally out of their control and that's hard.
But I mean, like I said, I wouldn't change it, but if I could go back and tell my earlier self, be like, maybe don't try to put it off, or maybe, oh, it'll happen, you know, think about it sooner. But then again, I think I'm glad I didn't have kids in grad school, because I wasn't with my current husband in grad school. Yeah. So that would have been a totally different life and a totally different experience. I wouldn't have ended up at Hollins, you know, I'd probably still be in Indy somewhere. You know, so I'm glad my path took the journey that it did.
Yeah.
But there were moments. Yeah.
It happened all in the right timing, how it was supposed to happen.
Yeah. So thank you for having me on.
Oh my gosh, Shelby, I love talking with you.
This has been fun.
Sharing your story with us. Yeah. I loved hearing this.
Thank you, Shelby, so much for coming on our show. I am so glad you came on and got to talk with us. If you have a mom note you'd like to share with us, if you went through IVF or if you teach higher ed, we would love to hear from you. You can send us your mom notes at momnotespod@gmail.com, or you can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram and message us there too.
Yeah, thank you, Shelby. We love talking with you. We loved hearing your story. And I'm sure it makes a lot of mamas out there who have had fertility treatments or are hoping, gives them hope, and makes everybody feel a little less alone. And, you know, you're rocking the higher ed world, and we're so grateful that you came to talk with us.
We'll see you all next time. We have a special treat for Father's Day coming out next time.
Look
forward to hearing from you all then, and have a great rest of your week.
Bye.
Bye.
And I was not prepared to see myself in him. Every once in a while, my, you know, Donna will say, like, can you stop sighing? Because I'll give kind of this little exhale under my breath. And he did it the other day. Not to me, just like in his room, he was playing with Legos and he stopped with this little exhale. And I was like, oh no, no, no. He's picking up my habits, you know? Or he'll say, okay, what's next? Like, he'll want to make lists. So,
oh no, he's making his little spreadsheet.